Hey everyone, it's Duncan Crary. You're listening to The Kunstlercast, a weekly conversation about the tragic comedy of suburban sprawl featuring James Howard Kunstler. Jim is the author of The Long Emergency, The Geography of Nowhere, and The World Made by Hand novels. This weekend, we were visited by author Matt Dellinger, who's just published a book about a mega highway proposed to go from Canada to Mexico through the American heartland, which is where Matt comes from originally, in Indiana. He now lives in Brooklyn, New York, and got here by train. We're going to tell you more about his book in one moment, but I will let you know that Matt has written for The New Yorker, The Wall Street Journal Magazine, The Oxford American, and The New York Times, and he also blogs for Public Radio's TransportationNation.org. If you'd like to learn more about Matt while you're listening, you can visit mattdellinger.com. That's Dellinger. Well, Jim, it's good to see you again. We have a special guest today.
It's the first time we've actually had a live one in the studio. We had to throw out a long line with a hook on it.
Matt Dellinger. Matt, thanks for being here today.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Great to be here.
And Matt has just written a book called Interstate 69, The Unfinished History of the Last Great American Highway. Can you tell us a little bit about your book? What is this book about?
Interstate 69 is kind of it's the NAFTA highway is what most people would have heard of it as. But it's an interstate plan that came about around 1990. And it's supposed to connect Indianapolis to Mexico through Memphis and Houston and Shreveport. And basically the book it takes a look at the project and the history of the project, the politics, the local economics. It's really a story of development in America and who's trying to build this road, who's trying to stop this road. And what kind of effect will it have on all the places it'll go through?
So, Matt, this is a 1,400-mile highway. Now, is it 1,400 miles complete, or is it planned to be 1,400 miles?
The extension from end to end will be about 1,400 miles. Right now, Interstate 69 exists, a piece of it, from Indianapolis north to Canada through Michigan, makes a wide loop around Detroit. It goes through Flint and Lansing. And that piece was part of the original interstate system. But the extension that is now imagined by this group of people, the Mid-Continent Highway Coalition, they call themselves, will be about 1,400 miles. When it gets down to Houston, for political reasons, that it's mapped out as splitting into three pieces just to keep three different cities along the border happy. And there are sort of offshoots of it in Arkansas that were also political compromises. The whole route of I-69 is kind of the result of immense horse trading and pushing and pulling by big politicians in the Clinton era.
What were the actual expressed interests of the Mid-Continent group that was behind this? I mean, what did they think they were going to benefit from?
Well, that's a very interesting point, and actually it's part of what why I wrote the book is as this unfolded, as I started to realize how different the prerogatives were up and down the route. I mean, in Indiana, they thought that building this would create jobs. It would stimulate the economy. You contrast that at the other end of the route in Texas, they felt like, well, our state is growing. We need to build this just to keep up with growth. We need somewhere to put the growth. So, and obviously in the Mississippi Delta, the thinking was we're completely poor. Our economy needs a kick in the pants. And it was similar to Indiana. If we build this highway, then we can get a Toyota plant. We can get some other major employer to come and put themselves down and put all these people to work. I would say it's really about jobs was the main thing. The NAFTA part of it, the kind of globalization angle, was mostly something that was for the ears in Washington, D.C. If you want to convince Congress to fund this, you can't say, well, the people in the Mississippi Delta and southern Indiana need jobs.
Because those are local public works.
Yeah, everybody needs jobs. Yeah. Everybody's right. Home district wants some kind of economic development. So when they took it to Washington, when they wrote their big think papers, when they got the HNTB of the world to do a study saying it was feasible, that had to be about the truck traffic that was going to happen between Mexico and Canada.
Wasn't there a lot of disagreement about whether it was a good thing to have jobs either, that there was some idea that actually more jobs would be sucked out of the United States and what we would get in return would simply be a lot of truck traffic from Mexico?
Yeah, I mean, the history of the reaction to this road it ties in very interestingly to the history of our ideas about NAFTA. I mean, the idea of the road came about almost the same month that NAFTA was ratified.
Yeah.
And, you know, there was reason to be optimistic. It was as easy to believe the optimism as it was to believe the pessimism. And now, you know, you have people in southern Indiana who've watched the Whirlpool plant go to Mexico. They've watched the RCA plant go to Mexico. Their jobs have literally gone to the place where this highway is supposed to connect.
There's a kind of an original dreamer character in the who starts this thing in motion.
Right.
An Indiana businessman.
Mm-hmm.
I forget his name.
David Graham.
Right. And David Graham is inherits a large kind of multifaceted family business. It involves farming and land development and, you know, just a kind of a typical Midwestern fortune,
mm-hmm.
you know? And he dreams this dream that they're going to have this vast north-south highway. And I'm very impressed with how this kind of Midwestern babbitry, you know, seems to be capable of big thinking at the same time that they're wearing blinkers. And they don't really have much of a sense of what the consequences of this stuff is going to be. And especially the fact that they're coming from a very bland, vanilla Midwestern world where all the cultural differences have been flattened out by, you know, interstate commerce and chain stores, and much of which they've been a part of in constructing. His family is sort of the typical family in America that has been part of the flattening of America.
Yeah.
You know, I'm just amazed at the sense that he couldn't see anything that might be a diminishing return coming out of this.
Well, to take a look specifically at David Graham, his father, Robert Graham, was the head of the Automotive Chamber of Commerce back in the 1920s.
Yeah.
And he used to go to these big international meetings about building the Pan American Highway.
Mm-hmm.
His dad had been a real estate developer down near Miami Beach. His father and two uncles made automobiles in Evansville. And he grew up in this kind of pre-World War II heyday of, you know, where the people of means who were making cars also got to drive them all over the place and develop this land, and all these places were accessible that weren't accessible before.
Many Americans, I think, have no idea how bad the roads in America were just before the First World War.
Yeah.
There were, look, only a few hundred miles of paved roads in the entire United States before the First World War.
As I say in the book, yeah, in 1903 is when Horatio Nelson Jackson was the first guy to drive across the country, and it took him 63 days. And we had a transcontinental railroad at this time that covered the same ground in 4 days. And so roads were, you know, the vast majority of mileage of paved roads were inside city limits. And the idea of driving from one city to another was preposterous. I mean, it was you had to go through fields and you'd find the two ruts from the guy who had gone just before you, and you follow his ruts.
One thing that fascinated me about this family was that they had come up in that. They sort of symbolized, they epitomized the absolute being at the absolute center of this
exactly
fantastically dynamic system that was arising out of the U.S. and arising out of the Midwest to turn us into a nation on wheels.
Mm-hmm.
And they were also very keenly aware of the amount of capital wealth that produced.
Right.
So they were very behind the idea that, of course, you build more roads, you'll get more wealth, mm-hmm. no matter how you do it.
David Graham is sort of, his biography is makes him exactly perfectly suited to wanting to build Interstate 69. And the story of how the idea came about, there was actually an effort to build a road between just Evansville, Indiana, and Indianapolis, a few hundred miles, since the 1960s. I mean, they saw the original interstate map and they were disappointed that, you know, the road didn't continue on to Evansville. So that was their kind of parochial interest for decades. David Graham got involved in this when he turned 60 and retired from the family businesses in the late 80s. He had hosted a economist named David Reed from the Hudson Institute, the very conservative Indiana-based Hudson Institute. And they're sitting around at breakfast, and Graham's showing him maps and saying, you know, if only, our idea is to build this highway. We think that would have a huge effect on the economy. But the state studies just keep saying it's not worth building. And Reed, having encountered this idea for the first time, looks at the maps and says, well, you know, what if you continued it? I mean, the whole reason, they're never going to build a road through Indiana, but what if you connect it to Memphis? What if you connect it to Houston? And they just kind of, over the map, they kind of drew where it would go to get to Mexico. But the idea never took off until David Graham himself, I mean, he took this notion of a multi-state highway corridor, and he drove the route himself, and he stopped in the Houston Chamber of Commerce, he stopped in the Memphis Chamber of Commerce, the Shreveport Chamber of Commerce, and just kind of cold called them and showed up and said, we've got this idea for a highway. And I try to put myself in the shoes of these local guys who, and why they would be so receptive to this. And in Shreveport, which is where the spark really hit, because the guy he talked to in Shreveport ended up running the Mid-Continent Highway Coalition. He ended up taking this map that they drew to his senator friend, who ended up, you know, manhandling legislation to put this road into a bill. His name was John Carruthers. He was interested because he had just spent 10 years, 20 years trying to improve navigation on the Red River. And he, you know, he knew it could be done. He knew that a small group of people could get together and muster the political will to ream out a river or build a road or just change the map in some way.
Behind this is the interesting idea that none of these guys, even for a moment, wondered whether we were going to run into problems with petroleum up ahead. There's the assumption going all through this that, sure, we will construct this massive infrastructure, and then we can depend on having the stuff to run on it. Mm-hmm. It'll all be there, and everything will be perfect. And they didn't. It never seemed to occur to them. I mean, one of the things that really fascinates me is the idea that this now, as yet unfinished highway, has the possibility of perhaps being completed at the exact moment that the trucking industry falls apart on the heels of a kind of a global energy shortage, scarcity, predicament problem.
Right. I mean,
it's one of the paradoxes of history, one of the ironies of history. And all of the tremendous amount of effort and thinking and thought and planning that went into this, you know, as blinded as it was, you know, is just kind of staggering when you consider the outcome.
Yeah. And the reason for my subtitle, The Unfinished History of the Last Great American Highway, people ask me about that all the time. Why do you think it's the last? And it just is. I mean, there's 100 reasons. And we can't even in Washington agree to fix the roads we have, let alone build new ones. And everything points to just us being, the whole mechanism that existed for building roads is exhausted.
You know, I have a sort of a theory also that goes along with that, and I'm interested in what your reaction is that, you know, we have insidiously spent 90 years elaborating a giant system that is now too large and too complex to be cared for competently. Mm-hmm. And also, along with the fact that we're in a situation where capital is disappearing so quickly, we simply don't have the money either to attend to it.
That's true.
So the destiny of the whole interstate system is kind of in question.
There's a couple named Thomas and Sandra Tokarski in southern Indiana who, from the moment they heard about this highway idea, fought it. And they fought it when it was just going to go to Evansville. And then they fought it even more when they found out it was going to go through their backyards. And they fought it even more when they learned it was going to go to Mexico. But the point they always kept trying to make was, look, you're telling us you can't repave this pothole-filled road here. And yet the state wants to spend $1.5 billion or more, $2-3 billion to build this road that we don't need, and we're trying to demonstrate we don't need it. The priorities do seem a little out of whack. I do want to go back though, and you know, the characterization of the people who bought into this. I think it's interesting, and this comes out in the book. Most of the people I interview are fairly old. You know, the median age of the people championing this road at this point is probably 65. Who are really in the thick of building it. I think that they're of a generation where they watched, you know, I was from town A, town B was the same size, the interstate system was built through town B doubled in size, we shrank. And so their experience all points to
that prosperity really hinges on whether you get the highway or not.
That's what they see. And, you know, they say, whatever, the generals are always fighting the last war. I think economic development people are always looking for the last thing that made the towns nearby prosper. But it's a huge question mark about whether this kind of economic development would actually happen. Would it create jobs in southern Indiana, or would it move them from two counties over?
Well, let's talk about what happened in the Mississippi Delta.
Yes.
And why don't you explain what the Mississippi Delta is geographically for people who might be confused about it?
Oh, yes. It's not down near New Orleans. It's not where it's not an alluvial delta where the river spits out into the ocean. It's It's the term we use for the region basically just south of Memphis, where between the Yazoo and the Mississippi River. And these were...
Well, they were bottomlands mm-hmm. that were, in other words, low-lying land between two very big rivers
right.
that periodically put a lot of silt into that area between them.
Very fertile
and created soil. Extremely fertile, dark, black soil. And that's what characterizes the delta.
And actually, originally it was forest. Clarksdale is named for Clark, who was a logger. So they cut down every tree in sight, basically, to make farmland, and they leveled it with, you know, basically mules and human hands. And now it's, you know, in the 1920s, it was where blues was born. It was tons of sharecroppers and...
Very high black population.
A majority black population in many of these towns. And the economy there was based on agriculture, but more specifically, it was based on an agriculture that required a lot of human effort. And the mechanical industrial revolution, the mechanization of farming, is part of what spurred the great migration north of blacks to the industrial cities, because suddenly two guys in a tractor, a John Deere, could do what used to take 100 hands to do.
Yeah, and I think the mechanical cotton picker per se was actually put into production in like 1948 or so,
right?
Rather late in the game, and then that also increased the flow to Chicago and Detroit.
But I know you love mules.
I love mules. I'm all about mules.
I spoke to the economic development guy in Clarksdale, Mississippi, who was remembering the mules and the farm that his dad worked on, and how when they bought the tractors, they kept the mules alive. I mean, they kept feeding the mules because they knew their names and they knew their lineages.
Their mules,
and,
yeah.
you know, it was just, it was, they were parts of the family. So it was kind of... You know, it's a bittersweet. The progress in the Delta has been bittersweet. It's left a lot of people behind.
Well, and that was sort of what I was going to get at, which is that when very intensive human labor agriculture went away, that all of a sudden the idleness and unemployment in the Delta was huge. It mm-hmm. was one of the most economically depressed parts of the country.
Yes.
So the way out of it was something that sort of came out of left field that nobody had been thinking of.
Right, gambling. Both Mississippi and Tennessee are conservative states, but Tennessee sort of kept its girdle on longer. But Mississippi passed basically riverboat gambling, and they built these casinos in Tunica back in 1991.
And by the way, these riverboats are a curious thing. I think we've touched on them before in this uh-huh. podcast. The idea that they don't really have to be riverboats. They sort of pretend to be riverboats, but they're really structures that are only 6 inches off of the mainland.
Don't you have to buy a ticket and then it pushes off about 15 feet?
No.
That's how it sets sails, and you can't get on or off.
Well, I think there are different laws in places like Iowa and Illinois. And
Cincinnati you actually have to be on a boat. But
yeah, but I think the ones in Mississippi are essentially just building structures that pretend to be boats that aren't.
I think they have to float once a year is the law.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh.
To prove that they're
who knows how they do that
river worthy, but they're all built on the river side of the levee
yeah.
is the point, and they're, you know, they could all be washed away. Usually the hotel is on the safe side and the casino is, you know, in a destructible part of the complex.
But that did bring a huge amount of jobs.
It was a game changer. And yeah. this was the area where Jesse Jackson called it America's Ethiopia. You know, it was the poorest place in the country. Unemployment was through the roof. And they allowed gambling. And basically anyone who wanted a job could have one. Anyone who, you know, could hold a job could have one. And the taxes, the local taxes, went sky high. And so now you drive through Tunica along Highway 61, the storied Highway 61, the blues highway that Bob Dylan sings about, and where perhaps Robert Johnson sold his soul to the devil.
At the crossroads.
At the crossroads.
So a lot of that money that they generated from gambling was funneled back into the highway building, though.
Yeah, correct? Exactly. So
it's sort of a self-reinforcing
situation. You drive along Highway 61 now, and you see in Tunica, brand new high school, brand new middle school, brand new civic center, a museum, a local museum, an expo center. They've had tons of tax money. And the way that they built, in 2006, the first segment of the new Interstate 69 was open to traffic. And it was in northern Mississippi. And the reason this was the first part built was because the casinos wanted to be on the interstate system. They wanted an interstate quality road between I-55... just east of there, and Tunica.
Is that an east-west road?
East-west goes north-south, down to Jackson, Mississippi, Memphis to Jackson. But this piece of I-69 goes directly east-west.
Oh, okay.
Even though it's more or less a north-south highway. But it's going to make a new, a kind of a squared-off loop around Memphis that's so big. We can talk about that, the outer loop thing, because it's creating outer loops in Memphis and Houston. But the loop is so big that it goes into Mississippi. Mississippi paid for it. There was an obscure law in the books that allowed the state to build roads with money that the county could front them.
And in a way, you know, it makes us seem like we're absolutely road crazy at a particular juncture of history when it might be kind of a dangerous thing. We're building more and more circumferential highways around, you know, third-tier cities and second-tier cities.
Right, and even small cities that, you know, a bypass. So, you know, the town of Lufkin, Texas, is on US 59. And right now, if you're driving from Houston to Texarkana, you have to drive through Lufkin. And part of the idea of having a controlled access interstate is that you'd just blow around town. So all these places that you now have to go through the middle of, you could go around, which means you'll see roadside services that pop up, gas stations and restaurants.
And they'll contribute to the destruction of the old centers of the old towns.
And the downtown will shrivel up.
I do want to get to a point, though, which is that, you know, with this Highway 69 and all the action around gambling in the Delta, you're starting to get a very interesting distraction from what the supposed original purpose of the highway is, you know, to facilitate commerce between the USA, Canada, and Mexico. That sort of changed over the years, too, especially vis-a-vis what was going on between the USA and Mexico.
Right.
Now you have I would say, you know, without trying to be too negative about it, you know, you have a lot of sort of ill feeling about Mexican workers coming across the border and doing jobs in construction, things that Americans and Canadians actually used to do. Sheetrocking, for example.
Right.
You know, which around here used to be traditionally a Canadian thing. You know, whenever you had like a big sheetrocking job, you'd call a bunch of Canadians down. This highway is this enormous project that is undertaken for a whole lot of different motives by different groups of people in different places. And it ends up having very weird, unanticipated consequences. You know, one of them is that we're starting to get a lot of new circumferential highways built at exactly the time in America when that's exactly the last thing that we need is more of that stuff. It reminds me of being in Montgomery, Alabama, which is a little further east from the area we're talking about. But, you know, when the stimulus money was handed out 2 years ago, they were deliriously happy because it was going to enable them to build a brand new limited access highway to the beaches in Florida, which were only 2.5 hours away in the first place. And now they were going to be 20 minutes closer.
Right.
But, you know, they had a 4-lane highway that was already there. It just wasn't a limited access highway with off ramps and clover leaves and stuff. It had grade crossings. But you didn't really have to stop at more than like 3 lights the whole way. It's the redundancy of highways that impressed me in the South. Now, I was always impressed by the fact that the southern states are very, very large.
Right.
And, you know, before they got underway with this heroic road building in the 20th century, they really couldn't travel very far from where they were. And, you know, in these huge states like Mississippi, where you could fit 17 Connecticuts in Mississippi and still have room left over for Maryland.
Right.
You know, so they've been kind of car crazy and road crazy in the southern USA for the last 90 years.
And I think the growth in the Sun Belt, all the Sun Belt cities are growing. And it's because, you know, air conditioning and highways allows these places that were not viable before to suddenly be places to live. And, of course, there's plenty of empty land.
People always underestimated how harsh the climate was in the Deep South. You know, when we sort of forgot, or we developed amnesia when we got air conditioning and cars, and then air-conditioned cars, and then air-conditioned houses all together into an ensemble of never-ending air conditioning.
Yeah, what you're saying is it's all absolutely right. And the main reason I wrote this book is because the more I kind of took in about the local coverage and the various arguments for and against the road, the more it struck me that this, you know, people were using this hypothetical highway as a kind of rallying point on which they project all of their hopes and fears about where they live and the differing perceptions about what's good for us. And then if, as I started to do historical research, it became clear that there was even more to think about. I mean, the small towns in southern Indiana, say, that are, whether they're for or against the highway, forget that they exist because of the railroad. You know, I mean, the railroad created them. And I started to compare sort of, in my own observation, has an interstate exit in the middle of nowhere ever created a real place? And I don't think it has. I don't think that, you know, when you get off a train, you're on foot, you need a hotel, you need a restaurant, you need a general goods store, all within walking distance. So a train stop, almost by definition, creates some kind of nucleus.
A walkable nucleus.
A walkable nucleus. And an interstate exit does not.
I am impressed with the fact that a lot of these towns were already badly damaged by the time that this highway idea came along.
And it's part of why they were so desperate for the highway idea. I mean, they were already dwindling, and they, you know, you can say they weren't thinking about the future, they weren't looking ahead, they weren't taking the truth into account. But you had towns that, you know, where the few local people with any kind of money and any kind of spirit left were just trying to raise enough, a few thousand dollars to put planters on the sidewalks downtown or clean up the light poles. You know, this was the level of stuff. And you also had a lot of, the way that economic development works was mind-blowing to me in this country. Towns building entire plants, empty plants, hooking them up to water, hooking them up to electricity, so that they could have a better chance of attracting a company.
And that is definitely like a cargo cult kind of thing, where, you know, the cargo cults were these South Pacific cultures where they got a lot of stuff coming into them during the Second World War. There were radios and, you know, K-rations and all kinds of interesting things they'd never seen before that they enjoyed. Mm-hmm. And when all the soldiers and airmen went away, these islanders started building wicker airplanes on the mountaintops in the hopes of attracting the airplanes to come back.
Really?
And deliver the magical cargo that they had come with. So in a way, this Southern American cargo cult activity is very similar.
That's amazing. Yeah, it's amazing. I'd never heard of that. That's
There's an anthropologist. I think he's passed away, but he was a great anthropologist from the University of Florida named Marvin Harris, and he wrote a whole book about this.
They still celebrate today. They have John Frum Day on one of the islands. They worship.
Was he an airman who brought them radios or something?
Yeah, he was this American airman. Yeah.
Well, I compare it in the book to a dowry. You know, there's these things called a megasite. Have you heard of a megasite? It's basically where a town sets aside 6,000 acres. They bring the railroad to it. They put a four-lane road near it. And they, you know, there's a certain criteria. And if you meet it, you declare it a megasite. And then if you're a car plant, you're a car company, you want to build a new plant, instead of going to each city and picking a site yourself, you just shop among the megasites that are already pre-identified.
Well, I guess what's really striking about what you're describing is how highly rationalized this process is, where, you know, you get a bunch of people who are basically kind of smart, and, you know, educated, trained, engineering types, you know, statistical analysis types, and sooner or later they'll come up with a formula or an algorithm for producing a certain outcome, which is, you know, get some industrial activity going where you are. You know, part of the problem with it is, though, you get all of this stuff in place and all of a sudden conditions in the world change, you know?
But it's interesting that you mentioned, what's his name, that the island that they have a day for him?
John Frum.
Right. Well, David Graham is kind of the John Frum. It's not like all of these small towns spontaneously came up with this idea for a highway by themselves.
Yeah.
A man came through town and said, we're going to build the NAFTA highway. It's going to change your lives.
Well, there's a name for that kind of guy. It's called a rainmaker.
Right.
But, you know, this leads me to the next question, which is, you hear the term the NAFTA highway, and there's a great deal of actual fear, animosity, paranoia about this. Let's approach this from two directions.
Okay.
One, let's talk about the authentic resistance to it. And then let's talk about the more delusional, paranoid areas that people,
yes,
that ideas are bubbling up from.
So, and those often blurred, but...
Yeah, but the actual genuine, authentic resistance in the form of rational people who were...
Exactly.
What was going on in that way?
Well, the people who were against it engaged the NAFTA. And again, the NAFTA element was a bit of a gloss that you put on nationally.
Like a sell job?
Yeah. If you went to some town in Arkansas and you said, why do you want I-69? NAFTA would, they would remember to mention it about half an hour after explaining how the local factory had closed down and they want to bring jobs back. So, you know, NAFTA was something that you, the glue that made this a project worthy of a great nation, sort of, you know, in the halls of Congress. But, and in 1990, when they first presented the idea of I-69, it seemed like that might be a good idea. Hey, the world's changing. We're globalizing. We're partners now. And when we built the interstate system, we built them all east-west because the challenge was to get goods from the middle of the country to the coast. And now we've got different challenges. We've got to get them from Canada to Mexico. The problem is that this argument did not age well. And the Mid-Continent Highway Coalition was soon forced to basically backpedal and step away from the NAFTA name. By the time the book was published, they were having conference calls to how to strategize to convince Congress that they were not the NAFTA highway.
How, explain how the idea aged poorly.
I'll say where it ended up, which was a congressman from Virginia introducing a bill saying it would be that the federal government cannot put money towards the NAFTA highway. And so that left the I-69 people scrambling with their lobbyists to make sure that they were not identified as the NAFTA highway.
Well, he must have had some vehement feelings about the...
It became a darling of the conservative movement because this the anger at globalization, the anger at losing jobs...
The sense that more stuff was being vacuumed out of the country than
right,
coming in.
That Ross Perot was correct. That, right. That, you know, that it had unplugged a drain and that all the jobs were just flowing down it. Now, you talk to the people on the border... They say, look, U.S. is not competing with Mexico for jobs. The U.S. and Mexico are competing with China. And so you can change your viewpoint a lot to get a lot of different ideas about this. But the fact was in southern Indiana, say, they were being told, look, you got to give up your farmland. You got to give up your peace and quiet. You got to give up your forest, your tiny college town of Bloomington and the way of life there so we can build this road to Mexico where all of your jobs have just gone. And the irony was too much for people to bear.
Yeah, so even people who weren't radical or
exactly,
terribly smart got it.
They were people who were arguing this isn't going to be a panacea. You're telling us it's going to bring us jobs, but the irony is the stated purpose of your road is to connect us to a place where our jobs are all going, and it will just make it easier for them to go there. Down in Texas, things were actually pretty quiet. Nobody really minded the idea of I-69 in Texas because they were going to use existing roads. They were going to upgrade US 59 and US 77. It wasn't going to be a big deal. A bridge here, you know, a crossing there. But what happened in sort of 2004, well, 2002, the governor of Texas presented this huge privatization scheme called the Trans-Texas Corridor that was going to allow private companies, many of them turned out to be from Spain, which only upped the ante for the jingoists, to operate brand new highways that were going to eat up all this farmland and ranchland in
Texas. Were they toll roads?
Toll roads. And that's how the company makes its money. And he thought this was a great idea. We're going to solve Texas's transportation problems into the next century.
By the way, didn't that one of those Spanish companies buy the Indiana Toll Road?
Cintra is based in Spain, and it partnered with an Australian bank called Macquarie. They acquired the Chicago Skyway in 2003 for, I think, $1.8 billion. And then they bought the Indiana Toll Road in 2006 for $3.8 billion. And these are basically, you buy an existing asset, as they're called, that has a revenue stream.
Like a cash register. It just goes ka-ching, ka-ching, ka-ching.
It's like a bond, but better. Because you can raise the toll rates. So,
which is like raising the interest rate on a bond.
Right. And it's something that, ironically, if a politician were to say, you know, the Indiana Toll Road's not even paying for itself. And Daniels, Governor Daniels of Indiana, did the math. He asked his people, how much does it cost us every toll we collect on the Indiana Toll Road? Okay, how much are we collecting? And, you know, they were collecting less than it cost them to collect it. And he said, why don't we just put out a cigar box and and we'll be ahead. So there's all these underperforming assets in the banker terms out there that are politically unviable to price them according to what the market might bear. So for an executive like a governor, it's a no-brainer. This company comes along and says, we're going to give you a huge payment now that's going to allow you to solve your budget problems. We won't raise the tolls for 5 years. We'll give you basically a fuse. It will give you time to get out of town. And then by the time we're jacking up the rates, A, we're going to be protected legally because people can bitch all they want, but they can't do anything to us because we have a contract. And two, we'll make back the money slowly. We're patient. You know, this is patient money. It's Australian pension funds and whatnot. We just want a 2% return or something.
Was there ever any discussion of what their maintenance responsibilities would be?
Absolutely. In fact, these companies are held to a much more stringent maintenance regimen than the state DOT. The contract says if there's more than this many millimeters of snow, you must plow it within this number of minutes. Every dead animal must be removed within this number of minutes. They have these private companies actually have tow trucks patrolling these roads constantly.
Well, regardless of the reality of that, though, I gather that there's some sense among the citizens that they've lost control of something.
Yes.
That makes them nervous.
The American notion of the open road is something we don't want to think about the details of. We don't want to think about the real costs of it. We want to pretend that our gas taxes pay for our roads in full and that they should never have tolls on them and that raising the gas tax is unnecessary. But we haven't raised the gas tax since 1991 or two. It wasn't pegged to inflation or the price of gas. It's just a certain number of pennies per gallon. That money's become worth less, even as the cost of construction has gone up and even as our roads are aging and the maintenance costs are going up. So we're in a real pickle. The roads never paid for themselves, really, because of the external costs. But we're in a position now where the notion of I can get in my car and drive wherever I want for free needs to go away.
I was in Michigan last fall, and there was a tremendous amount of road fixing going on there, which it became clear to me pretty soon that this was stimulus money that was going to a state that had incredibly terrible unemployment problems. And so they were desperately trying to get people working on the highways because there was nothing else for them to make a living at. But it also prompted me to think, you know, maybe this is going to be like the last cycle of really heroic maintenance on this tremendous system that they have. And what happens next?
It's interesting. I did get to interview the guy who was the head of the Sintra operations in America. His name was Jose Maria Lopez de Fuentes. And I said, because if you look at it from this guy's point of view, he's coming from Europe where there's tons of privatized toll roads. It's normal there. And nobody fights them. And he's trying to build them in Canada and the U.S. And I said, what were you surprised about as far as our culture and the way we see our infrastructure? And he says, you're all riding around. Basically, you're living in a house your grandparents built. And you think it's free. But now the roof is leaking, you know. And now you have to fix the floors. And there's all this maintenance that you weren't really expecting. And it's a culture shock. I mean, we're not in the frame of mind to really build anything or even fix anything on a big scale. And I think, you know, this is a conversation that's happening in Washington, and it's unfortunate that we have a House of Representatives now that wants to starve the beast, so to speak.
Well, a lot of these people are heartland politicians, and, you know, they're going to find out that starving the beast is going to redound into the, you know, whether their localities can even function,
right.
whether they can care for the infrastructure that they have.
Right, but you're saying, you know, Amtrak needs to pay for itself. We're going to cut it, and if a route's not economically viable, then let it die.
Well, let me get to an even more macro sense of things. You know, I guess my idea that I've been trying to put across for the last 5 years is that we are coming into the twilight of the transportation system that we enjoyed for most of the 20th century into this one, which is basically you know, trucking and private cars. Mm-hmm. And we don't seem to be able to make any provision for doing it any other way. And the people who are, you know, our leaders in business and government don't seem to have any other vision of how to move people and things around this country. So how much of this is just a quixotic project?
I think it's very quixotic. You know, the book doesn't really take a side for or against. And when asked, do I think it will ever be built?
Completed.
My pretty confident answer is not all of it. You know, pieces are under construction now in Indiana and Mississippi and Texas. Pieces are open. I do not think it'll be built from Indianapolis to Mexico. I just don't. I mean, they might use shortcuts. They might change the route and say, okay, because it connects to 20 here and here, we'll call that stretch in between 69 also. They might find a way to cobble it together. But it just seems really doubtful to me unless we really pull our shit together. One of my favorite parts of researching the book was the historical part. And I didn't have, you know, I grew up thinking, A, the map was done, that someone, some smart group of people had decided what the map was going to be of the interstates, and that was it. I didn't really ride a passenger train until I was in college. So, you know, the whole reporting the book was a real eye-opener to me. But one thing, you know, you put it in perspective, you do a timeline, and you realize there was a canal era that lasted until the railroads, and then there was a railroad era that lasted basically until the roads, and you know, we're as far from the railroad era as the railroad era was from the canal era. And it's very believable that it's time for a new cycle. But another interesting tidbit, and I was mentioning this to Duncan the other day, every time a new mode came along, the older mode imagined itself in harmony with it. So the railroads, the canals, the canal people were excited about railroads because it would help people bring goods to the canals. And the railroad people were excited about roads because it would help the farmers get their goods to the railroads. You know, and at every moment there was a chance for a mix of...
For integration,
a mix of modes that all work together. And you see it still in places like New York, you know, in older places, in places where you can take a bus to a train, to a ferry, to a, you know... Every transportation mode kind of does the job it's best at. And no more and no less. And I think if there's a new era of economy coming up, it might just have a lot to do with us rediscovering that principle and saying, you know, maybe I will still own a car, but I'm not going to use it for absolutely every trip I make.
Well, I think that would be maybe a desirable outcome, or at least one that a lot of people would wish for. My own suspicion is that history is not symmetrical. Mm-hmm. And that, unfortunately, things don't necessarily go down the same arc they came up on. And in fact, what you end up with is a somewhat more disorderly disposition of things as things kind of come apart.
Right. And, you know, all of the imagined symbiosis between the different modes of transportation was done in by, you know, this greedy person or that.
For the most part, the canal system in the United States has been kind of neglected and ruined. We saw some yesterday in our journeys around the Champlain Canal, mm-hmm. you know, where the New York State Agency, for one reason or another, had taken care of them pretty immaculately for the last 150 years.
Yeah, and nice paint.
And they're still going. But, you know, I've been to the ones in the Midwest and, you know, the Baltimore and Ohio Canal mm-hmm. in Washington. They're just mere, you know, residue of what was there before. So, and the railroad system is also pretty obviously decrepit in some parts of the country.
In the last chapter of the book, I have some interviews with people, because as I was finishing my reporting is when Obama had taken office and he was suddenly talking about the high-speed rail network. And I'd go into people's offices to talk to them about I-69, and on their desk was the map of the high-speed rail system.
Yeah.
And I had a guy in northern Mississippi saying, you know, I was just on the phone with the Federal Railroad Administration. We've got to get on this map. We're not on this map. You know, and down in Texas, the guy saying, you know, well, this, the guy who was the head of the Harris County judge who was the head of the I-69 group in Texas, he's now working for a statewide high-speed rail group. And even David Graham, I went to see David Graham just before he moved out of Indiana to the Villages in Florida. And we were talking about his hometown of Washington, and he was reminiscing about how He went to school at Georgetown, and he used to get on the B&O right in town. He'd go to Cincinnati, he'd get off, he'd meet some friends, go to dinner, have a date, and then he'd go on to college on the train, and talking about how great that was. And he was saying, you know, I've told our Chamber of Commerce, we've got to restore passenger rail to this.
You know, but that's exactly the kind of mentality that just annoys me so much, is that, you know, he had that thought when he was 17, and he had that thought when he was 75. But in between those times, all he could think about was driving his Ford, you know, or his Toyota. And it just pisses me off so much. But I want to just get back to one point I was trying to make, which is that, you know, when you're talking about multimodal transportation in the USA, the problem at the moment is that all of the former modes of transportation are in a state of decrepitude. It's not as though they've kept up. And I'm not sure that the next thing is going to be that the automobile and trucking infrastructure will enter a state of decrepitude. But I also now want to veer into an area that we touched upon, because I'm always interested in paranoia movements.
Yes.
And there's a great deal of paranoia out there that the NAFTA highway, the I-69 highway, represents a movement toward the dreaded North American Union, which is a paranoid cult idea that the U.S., Mexico, and Canada, that shadowy figures in the background want to unite all three nations and turn them into one gigantic super nation that will then be run by shadowy, gangster figures of some kind. And they will impose a new money on us called the Amero. I hasten to add, I don't believe this for a moment. I think that I put it in that special folder I have that is labeled complete fucking nonsense. But it's interesting to talk about.
You're absolutely right. This road ran afoul of people who believe that. And the interesting thing to me was the people it ran afoul of included extremely conservative ranchers in Texas and extremely liberal, like vegan anarchists in Bloomington, Indiana, who were all telling me the same stuff about how, you know, there was this secret agreement between Canada, Mexico, and the U.S., and it was part of, the idea was to take the natural resources from Canada and the cheap labor of Mexico and the consumer base of the U.S. and shake it all up and make a European Union type thing, and we'd do away with the dollar, we'd have the Amero.
Richard Hofstadter was right. Richard Hofstadter was the great historian of the mid-20th century who wrote a book titled The Paranoid Style in American Politics, I believe was the title. And the fact is, there's a lot of paranoia out there in America.
Yeah. And so in Texas, the John Birch Society was revived kind of around this issue.
And interestingly, let me point out that, the John Birch Society was sort of suppressed, at least suppressed out of the Republican Party, only through the efforts of William F. Buckley for about 35 years in the late 20th century. And when Buckley passed away, the John Birch Society popped back on the scene, you know, in full flower.
Well, I think the internet has allowed quote unquote information to spread very easily, such that, you know, if you're reading, I forget his name, the guy who wrote the Swift Boat book about John Kerry.
Yeah, he's a political activist, right-wing nut.
He wrote a whole book about this, The Late Great USA, and it talks about the NAFTA highway. And I read it for any shred of evidence that I could refute. But he doesn't even bother to produce evidence. He says that this meeting happened, and although everyone denies it, this was the agreement. And the fact that it was never reported in the real press, the New York Times, is further evidence of the mendacity of these
people. It's against the interest of paranoiacs to uncover the truth, because if you did actually uncover any truth, there wouldn't be any shadowy mysteries for them to support their paranoia with.
Yeah.
So it's important to maintain the shadowiness of it.
And just to be clear, in the Interstate 69 plan involves zero new crossings of the border, zero change in border policy. It's just a road that plugs into the existing border infrastructure and goes through the heartland. But if you take a certain map off a certain website and you misinterpret it in a certain way, it can look like a huge, scary plan.
Let me ask you kind of a final unifying question, just personally, as someone who's really gotten deeply into the American transportation issue. What's your picture of where we're heading with how we're going to move around this large continent?
I can imagine regions operating with a great deal more rail infrastructure, maybe up here anyway, a revival of the waterway infrastructure. You know, the Ohio River system built many a major city and probably could be, you know, there's many more barges that could flow up and down that river. But as far as the country, I mean, there was a concern that when the nation was young and not tied together with infrastructure, that it would fall apart, that the Spanish or the French could come up from wherever and basically take over a whole part of the country and we'd be left isolated from that, you know. So transportation is kind of interwoven with our whole idea of manifest destiny and, you know, and the power of our geography. But it's our geography that makes transportation such a challenge. How are we going to get those avocados from California? How are we going to get sell our goods from the industrial heartland if we ever start up our factories again to the markets out west? And will it be quite as simple?
Where will the interstate system be in 25 years?
I think that the interstates will still be a backbone of the country. I don't think they're ever going to be like turn into a meadow, you know, and someone traces the lines and say, this used to be the great route between Dayton and Cincinnati.
It won't be like Planet of the Apes where somebody stumbles out into a pavement and says, oh my God, this was the interstate highway.
Right. But you know, we are right now organized around the interstate system. The way that I talk about where I live in Brooklyn by the subway stops I live near, most people talk about where they live by what highway exit.
They don't even talk about the distance that they travel. It's always the time.
Right. And so we could maintain that organizing principle of the interstates and yet increase the number of modes that ride on the interstate. If you could do with, in the short term, you could do with buses what people might be tempted to do with trains. Instead of trying to revive the interurban train system and lay down all that track and build all those cars, you could do a lot with a bus network that just went from this exit to that exit to that exit.
It's funny, when I think of that, though, I think of us getting to sort of, you know, the Latin American level of that, where you have too many people in the vehicle and a lot of, you know, cages with chickens on them and on the roof.
Well, who knows? I mean, that's...
well, we don't know exactly
stick that in your next novel, but...
Yeah, right.
But the notion in my mind is... That highway exits, as I said before, have not created nucleuses for development, for towns, but they could if you just change what travels along those interstates.
Do the people in your home part of the country, in the Midwest, in Indiana there, do they feel any sense of loss for the original towns that were there in the first place?
I think the more they learn about them, the more they feel the loss. But as one who grew up without even realizing that there used to be trains in Indiana...
Uh-huh.
No, most of them don't know enough to feel the loss. But there's a scene in my book where I go to the Indiana State Museum, and you can stand, and they've got that kind of plastic cup in the sky with a speaker in it, so if you stand under a certain place, it sounds, you know. And there's a place you can stand and hear the clanging of the bells of the old interurban trains and the whistle and the announcement, you know, Terre Haute, 20 minutes, da-da-da-da. And it's like... In the same museum, there's a plexiglass case where you can smell cow manure and hay and different agricultural smells.
Oh, gosh.
And it gives one a creepy sensation that these things are being preserved because they'll be so lost that it won't, you know, maybe my grandkids won't feel in touch at all with what a train might have been like. But I refuse to believe that it's gone. I mean...
And I happily imagine that Americans are going to be reacquainted with cow shit much more quickly than they right. expect.
In the Kunstler Museum in Troy, they're going to be smelling car exhaust.
No, they're going to be... They'll have a little canister of that new car smell.
Yeah.
So that it'll be the off-gassing upholstery of the new car and the off-gassing plastic in the dashboard.
Exactly. And this podcast will play on a loop for visitors.
Well, I think that's a wrap. Matt Dellinger, thank you so much for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks a lot, man.
That was a lot of fun. You guys are a good time.
And Jim, I think we're going to have some more guests on this show. What do you think? It's a
absolutely.
Lot of fun.
Absolutely. We've got to cast some more lines with some more, bait it maybe with some gummy worms or cheese doodles and see what the ocean of personalities dredges up.
Yeah, and I think, Matt, you and I are going to see each other again, and Jim, at the Congress for the New Urbanism this year, right?
That's right, yeah. There's a lot of longtime listeners, first-time guests ready and waiting for you guys, I bet.
Yeah, we'll rope a few in there at the conference.
Okay, later, Gary.
Thanks a lot. You've been listening to the KunstlerCast featuring James Howard Kunstler. To leave a listener comment, call toll-free at 866-924-9499. Send email to letters@kunstlercast.com. You can listen to all of our past programs, join our email list, find out how to book Jim to speak in your area, and talk about the show with other listeners at kunstlercast.com. I'm your host, Duncan Crary. Thanks for listening.
The first taste of rare bourbon you finally got your hands on. That's nice. At Caskers.com, we make this experience easy. Caskers is a one-stop spirit curator with an impressive selection of exclusive, sought-after, rare, and household names in the realm of premium spirits and champagne. Discover the top flavors of the year now by going to Caskers.com and using code WELCOME10 for $10 off your first purchase. Get $10 off your first purchase with code WELCOME10 at Caskers.com.